Okay, so this is the toy that we were playing with when we stopped yesterday. To summarize, electrostatic potential satisfies Poisson's equation. Okay, curl of E is equal to zero, but then divergence E is equal to rho. When you combine the two together, you get this equation that we derived last time, which is del square V is equal minus rho over epsilon naught. Okay? And then this equation itself reduces to del square V equal to zero in all those places where the charge density rho, volumetric charge density, is equal to zero. Okay? So this is Poisson's equation, this is the Laplace's equation. We were applying these equations to the following types of scenarios. We were imagining the existence of some metallic bodies that, by definition, can only support one value of voltage or potential on each body, right? Because inside the conductors, there is zero electric field. That means the potential associated with the entire interior of a conducting body is a constant. But those constants are not important. What is important are relative differences between those constants. So we can assign this zero, then we ask the question, what is the voltage here with respect to this? And it may also be zero, depending on the charge distributions around, or maybe it's non-zero, okay? The problem that we are solving here, based on Laplace's equation, relates to the potentials in surrounding areas of two metals, which have been arbitrarily assigned plus one and minus one voltages. Okay, so we have plus one voltage here, minus one voltage here. That's true throughout the entire plate, bottom plate, top plate. In between, there is a potential distribution, V, of x, y, z, but we made the problem two-dimensional, so we don't worry about the z direction. Therefore, V of x, y. That satisfies this equation, written explicitly, d squared V, dx squared plus d squared V, dy squared, plus d squared V, dz squared, but that term is absent in this case because it's a two-dimensional problem. This is equal to zero. This is the Laplace's equation for that situation. Okay, so that V has to both satisfy this, and when you approach any of these boundaries, top, bottom, plate boundaries, V should go either plus one or minus one. This is the problem that we solve. How did we solve this? We discretized this equation, and when we discretized this equation, we came up with some magical formula, okay? Voltage at any point is the sum of four neighbors that it has divided by four. That was the formula, and that was a two-dimensional case. What if I were to apply this in a three-dimensional situation? What do you think, how do you think that result would generalize?
You just take the ones in the z-direction as well.
Right, so then you have six. You add six neighbors and divide it by six. That would be the, so but that for that you would have to write a program. And you're not writing a program, you're taking advantage of an Excel sheet that can do this problem iteratively. Any questions? That's where we were. Okay, and then what we did was, and I'm not going to repeat that, most of you were here. Others who are not here, who were not here, have access to the same file and can do this. This file was originally all zeros. It was zero everywhere. Every grid point, this is a 32 by 32 grid, every point was zero in this, zero potential. But there was something interesting. Every cell was connected to its neighboring cells by a formula that you see in that formula on the top. What it says that at some location, the value of the potential is the sum of all its four neighbors divided by four. Okay? And that, of course, can be satisfied if zero is everywhere, zero plus zero plus zero plus zero divided by four is still zero. So that was a situation that could be supported. But then what did I do? I painted this region here with plus one. And I painted this region here with minus one, assigning the plus one and minus one into two conducting plates. And when I did that assignment, I changed the formulae by fixed quantities. Inside those regions, I no longer have the formula of adding the four neighbors and dividing by four. This is a constant. And then I iterate it, boom, boom, boom. And what we see here is the potential distribution from plus ones into minus one, from green to red to yellow. You see a continuum distribution. Okay? A plot of the same thing is a three-dimensional object. Okay? View of XY above an XY plane is this picture. And I blew it up here a little bit. And you can quite nicely see that at that location in between the two plates, I have a very sharp variation, very steep variation of the potential as a function of position. In fact, as a function of, I would say, y. It changes in y direction and not in x direction. Therefore, there is a y-directed electric field that is pointing from the positive to negative plate. Okay? But outside, we have also some potential variations. I associate them with what we call fringe fields. A very strong inner field here that is almost constant and doesn't change in this direction until you approach the sides, and then you have fringe fields. Okay? So that's the potential distribution. In my mind, I take its gradient, I can see the electric field. And if I know the electric field at the surface of the two plates, I can translate that into also what? State. Charge density. Because the field at the surface of this is going to go from a finite value into zero value because the field is zero inside, and that is only sustainable according to the boundary condition equations that we learned last time if there is a surface charge density that is specifically satisfying which equation? M dot?
D plus minus D minus.
Equals rho sub s, that equation. Okay, so that way you can get the charge density. You can get the charge density everywhere. Now, if you look at behind the plate, the potential there is almost flat, but it's not exactly flat. It is still changing a little bit. If it is changing a little bit, there is an electric field that is large or small? Small. Okay, and a small jump in the electric field will then mean on the back side a charge density that is also small. Okay, so that is how the charge density distributes itself. A very intense charge density in the inner plate, the inner surface of the up, and a weaker charge density. And then if you take entire charge density distribution on that conductor and integrate over that surface, what do you get? The total charge. Okay. And what would you also get if you integrate the electric field from one plate to the other plate, following any path? What would you get? You would get the potential difference, which we know in this case is 2, because it's plus 1 minus 1 difference. Okay, so then we have found there is a charge on the positive. The negative one has equal and opposite charge. And then there is a voltage difference. And then there is the ratio of the voltage and the charge. And that is called? That is called? You can say Q equals C times V. And that C is called? Capacitance. Okay, and that capacitance depends on? The geometry, the distance, etc. Okay, this is something that we're going to come in within a couple of lectures. So that was the gist of this example. Any questions here? How many of you downloaded this? Have you played with it? Okay, so there are pages called Neumann and Dirichlet. And Neumann and Dirichlet pages have different boundary conditions. I use Neumann here, and in the Neumann, if I click on any one of these boundary cells, I see the specification that potential is exactly the same as its neighbor right here, next neighbor. Okay, I am fixing basically the derivative, the normal derivative at the boundary to be equal to zero. This is one type of a boundary condition. Another boundary condition would have to give some value to the potential at the edge. Okay. And it turns out that really we are trying to, in a 32 by 32 domain, we are trying to find out what the field distribution of a parallel plate capacitor would be. And the problem that we are really attacking is one in which we want to imagine this capacitor with two plates embedded in an infinitely large region. Okay, but our Excel sheet is forcing us to work in a finite region. So we find that boundary condition that gives us more or less the more realistic situation, and the situation in which the normal gradient is equal to zero is sort of better. What is the normal gradient of the potential? Say it. You take the gradient of the potential you get. What do you get? What parameter do you get? What physical parameter do you get? Gradient of the potential is the electric field. I'm sort of saying that, well, I hope that by the time I'm far away from the capacitor, the electric field has petered out to zero. So that's why I'm going to set the gradient of the voltage to be zero. And the gradient of the voltage to zero is being enforced by making those two neighbors to have the same value. So that's what we're doing there. Okay, any questions here? So then, if no questions, let's move on. But let's remember a certain lessons out of this, okay? We will come back to capacitor-like situations quite frequently, okay? And frequently, there will be situations where I can measure or estimate a field by making some idealizations and ignoring certain little things. In this case, what I would ignore in most applications of this type of geometry is the fringe fields. I know that there are fringe fields, but they are in general weak compared to the other fields. So I will say, hey, I'll idealize this problem, pretend there are no fringe fields, pretend all the electric field is confined in between the two plates. And that is a good approximation if the size of these plates are large compared to the separation. Okay. The energy content of the field that is uniform and in between the plates is going to be dwarfing the energy content of the fringe field, and we can say, hey, let's forget about the fringe field. That's tough to do on paper. It's not tough to do in the computer, as we have shown. You can always go to numerical models if you want to include it, but then you want to make progress on paper and pencil, blackboard basis, and we will often forget about fringe fields in that sense. Okay, so let's hide this guy. And let's get to the rest of our lecture. So yesterday we didn't finish our lecture. We are a little bit behind. This is the topic that we started. Okay, here are the equations. Now you see them on the blackboard. And we solved this equation numerically, but then the rest of the examples that I have that I will rush through are done by hand, and therefore they are idealizations, sort of forgetting about fringe fields, or assuming that the surfaces go all the way to infinity, okay? Those are pretty much the same thing. So in this particular example, I have two surfaces, okay, and one of them I assign zero voltage. I say the potential is zero arbitrarily there, and the second one has a potential of -3 volts. You can actually imagine these to be the two surfaces of a parallel plate capacitor situation, okay? And then you can either imagine it as in this problem that these surfaces are infinitely large, or you can say, well, it's not infinitely large, but it's large enough so that I will forget about the fringe fields and I will only solve this problem in this case by taking into account variation in this direction. So three-dimensional problem, in this example, collapse into two dimensions. Now we are going to collapse it into one dimensions. Okay? If the only variation is going to be in the top bottom direction, you also forget about the horizontal direction. Okay? And that's how you solve this problem. So our Laplace's equation in this case becomes del square v equals, let's say, call it second derivative of v with respect to z, the vertical variable, is equal to zero. All right. So that's our equation. Right. Our boundary conditions, and we know the voltage is zero at the bottom, it's equal to -3 on the top. So how do we match? What is the potential in between? What is the electric field that results? Well, now, if we have this type of a simple equation, the second derivative with respect to z of v is equal to zero, okay, you immediately conclude that v of c must be a linear function of c. There is an unknown constant a and b. There is a z variation. If you differentiate this once, you would lose B, you would get A, and the second differentiation would turn A into zero, so you would therefore satisfy Laplace's equation. So in one-dimensional problems of the type that we can do with paper and pencil, doing Laplace's equation is solving, basically it amounts to finding these boundaries, these constants in a way they would fit the boundaries or the specified boundary conditions in this problem. Okay. And because the at the bottom surface we have said B equal to V zero, then we should select B to be equal to zero and adjust A so that we reach a potential of minus 3 when we go up to whatever location that is specified here. At Z equals D, we have to reach minus 3 volts. And therefore, and is D given? D is 2 meters. So therefore, we have minus 3 and a half, minus 1.5 for the variable that is A. Straightforward. Okay? So when we simplify the problem all the way into 1D, these are very easy problems to solve. And otherwise, you have to do it numerically in many other situations. Unless there are some other symmetries that you can deal with, spherical symmetries and so forth. I'll skip this example. I'll quickly look at this example. Now, in this example, I will deal with the entire Poisson's equation rather than Laplace's equation, because in this equation, we are back to our double slab situation. We have a positive and negative slabs with space charge densities side by side. We had already worked this problem out. When we worked this problem out, we had found that there is an electric field that just looks like this, okay? And that electric field is expressed here in terms of a two-line formula. This is similar to one of the homework problems that you did. It was only harder, right? It was a three-slab problem that you guys did. So this is not unfamiliar. And in this case, if we look at it as the solution of Poisson's equation, this is the equation that we have to attack. D squared, dx squared, x is the variable in this direction of the scalar v, has to be matching the given rho sub x. And that rho sub x actually has the two slab parts, positive and negative parts. The first time I integrate that thing, okay, I go from the second derivative to the first derivative. When I go from the second derivative to first derivative, what do I physically have? I have dv dx. And what is dv dx? The electric field, except for the minus sign. Okay? Except for a minus sign, it is the electric field. So therefore, I'm basically going to solve this equation, Poisson's equation, by integrating it twice. The first time I integrate, I get a freebie, because I know what that result is. That is the electric field that we have worked out before, except for the minus sign. That is what I write here, okay? And what I get, therefore, two lines, and now in each of these lines, there is variation with x, right? That is because when I integrated over these two non-zero charge densities, the integration of a constant works out to be linear in the variable. Okay, a constant integrates into something that depends on x. So I've got two such quantities. In one of them, I have positive dependence on x. In the other one, I have negative dependence on x because my charge density had the two different signs. Okay. And those dependencies, of course, describe also the curve that we see here for the electric field, except for the minus sign correction. All right? So now we have our formula for dv dx. And how do we go from dv dx to v? We integrate once more. Or we find an antiderivative. We find some quantity that, when we differentiate, matches this. Okay? So let me blow this a little bit so that maybe you guys can. So this is harder to blow, make it bigger. I want to go like this, gesture, but it doesn't work. Oh, actually it does work here, yeah, okay. It does work on the little thing, on the panel, okay? So there is our quantity that we want to sort of integrate or find the antiderivative for, okay? So why don't I just take this bracket and square it and put a 2 underneath? And that is sort of like giving me an antiderivative. But of course, there is always some constant of integration that has to be encountered too. That's exactly what I have done here. I have taken the quantity there, squared it, divided by 2, and added a voltage, V1, some constant. And I did the same thing with the second guy. Okay. And now, when I differentiate, I go back to my previous equation. So I'm good there. Okay. And then you have to sort of like interpret what are these constants that I have added, okay? And The first line is pertinent for x less than 0 part. And if we go to our picture, I am sort of going through this because this is sort of an important example because it relates to ECE 340. Okay, that is why I'm going through this. Okay. So in the negative region, x less than 0, the width was W1. Okay, and it was at x equals minus W1 that the potential stops, the region, the slab stops. Okay, so let's keep that in mind. And then go to our equation here, our proposed potential solution. And it has a structure such that if I were to evaluate this line at x equals minus W1, this term totally disappears and potential is found to be V1. Okay? So now I know what my V1 is. I just added it there, but by interpreting the line, I know that my V1 is the potential at x equals minus W1. Likewise, I added a V2 that's on the second line, but the second line pertains to the sort of x greater than region of the geometry that we have, the positive slab. It's the edge of the positive slab. And the edge of the positive slab is at W2. I have x minus W2. If I were to evaluate this at the edge by putting x equals W2, this term would disappear, leaving me V2. Now I know what my V2 is. Okay? V1 and V2 have been introduced so that the picture here that we have is the valid picture. V2 is the potential that is assumed on the positive side. V1 is the voltage that is assumed on the negative side. And so really, numerically, what V1 and V2 are not so important, but what is more important is the difference between V1 and V2. Difference between V1 and V2 is the potential increase that is going to be experienced by any charge that is transiting this region in a given direction. Okay? So the relative values are what matters. And then to finish this problem, so let's go back and look at the logic. I still haven't sort of like yet related at this level V1 to V2 because they appear on these two different lines. But those two different lines have to agree where they are touching one another. And where they touch one another, where x is equal to?
Zero.
Okay? So then I sort of like equate those two things to one another at x equals to zero. Then I get this relationship. Now I have really an equation I can solve for V1 minus V2. And that is given here. All right? Any questions here? So there is a potential difference that is generated, and of course the entire thing is sort of like quadratic. We have electric field was linear, but we see that potential is gracefully quadratic because this variation with plus and minus x variation in the electric field, but it was integrated once more to go from the electric field to the potential, those x's went into x squared. The squaring comes and makes the whole result to be more graceful looking. So that's just the end of the story here. Okay. Any questions? This is the potential that shows up in diodes, in PN junctions, and responsible for the diode action. Current going easy relatively in one direction, but not going easy in the other direction. All right. So, Poisson's equation. So we did two Laplace equation problems. One example was with the Excel sheet. The other one was this very easy problem that we did, where we exploited the fact that the solutions of Poisson's equation in Cartesian 1D geometries is always going to be a linear function, ax plus b type of problem. Now we solve the Poisson problem, but let's look at the Poisson problem a little bit more generally. Suppose that you have a cloud of charge somewhere that is responsible for electric fields emanating from this region. What is the solution of Poisson's equation? What is the corresponding electric field? What is the general solution of Poisson's equation? It turns out that it is this guy. Okay? And you can show that to yourself in various ways, including remembering the formula for the potential of a single Coulomb charge. What was that formula like? We worked this out, right? A couple of lectures ago. I pointed out that the electric field, Coulomb electric field, goes as 1 over r squared, but the potential goes as 1 over r. Ah, yeah, there was a formula that sort of looked like Q divided by 4 pi epsilon naught r. That was the potential of a Q sitting at the origin and creating this potential distribution around it. We discussed this thing, okay? So now, if we have a charge distribution, something funny like this, throughout some region, some rho of XYZ, we can certainly break this charge distribution in our mind into tiny, tiny, tiny volumes. And within each volume element, we can consider rho in that element times dV to be like Q in the formula that just I mentioned. The formula that I just mentioned is V for a Q sitting at the origin is this guy, 4 pi epsilon naught r. And this is not a vector, this is a scalar. That's it, okay? So now I can say my dV. So into here I have a dV times rho. That is sort of like Q, okay? And if I have a lot of these dVs, all I need to do is take solutions of this type, okay, shift it, and add. And that addition, in the calculus sense, becomes an integral. So that is why we have that particular equation, okay? That particular equation, if you blow it up a little bit, is exactly saying that, okay? We have a rho times a volume element. That's a charge. We divide it by 4 pi epsilon naught, and we divide it then once more by the distance from where that volume element is to where the observation is being made, where we are evaluating the potential. And that is all making sense in the context of this diagram, okay? We have our charge distribution. This is the region that we have broken into little volume elements. We are interested in finding the potential here, an arbitrary point, V of r. V of r is Q there, that is the rho times the volume element. And now we are referring to the positions of that volume element in terms of dummy variables, vector r prime. That makes sense, right? When you integrate a function, you always integrate it across the dummy variable. Once you're done with the integration, dummy is gone. The result is left, okay? So that's why I have two position vectors. One is the position vector of the observation point. The other is the dummy position vector of the source, okay? I'm going to take the potential here due to one volume element to be rho times the volume divided by this quantity. But then I recognize I have a whole lot of them. I add them up, and that's my integral. Mike, making sense? That's it. So that's the general solution of Poisson's equations for situations where the charge densities are finite and not going all the way to infinity. Okay, that is a sort of an important subclass. Some of our hypothetical distributions that we consider take our charge density all the way to infinity. When we have an infinite plane charge, that is a different sort of a situation. But those are idealizations, right? In real life, that's not what you really encounter. In real life, everything is finite except for the universe itself, and the universe has its edge at infinity or 15 billion years ago or something like that. But then we don't have to sort of worry about that. And in that context, if we have sources that are dying away in charge density distribution, this is the general solution that we can use. Period. This is a And it's coming, again, from nothing other than superpositions of Coulomb fields now interpreted in terms of potentials. Any questions? General solutions of differential equations is something to be answered, right? And here is something general. This something general will require additions, integration. The way I treat this in the notes is slightly different from how I treat it in the class. There, I use delta functions and linear system theory arguments. Please read that, okay? If you have a single point sitting, a single charge sitting at the origin and its potential is known, you can look at that potential as the impulse response because that single charge is like an impulse in analogy with stuff that we've seen in ECE 210, okay? And then if you change the position of the impulse, you shift the impulse, then the impulse response also shifts because it's a linear shift invariant system. And then you have this shifted impulse responses. This is what mathematicians and physicists and even engineers call Green's functions, okay? So shifted impulse is the Green function. It is telling you what is the response for for a point source. And then finally, you can take all these point source responses, weight them with the same weights that the sources are weighted, and add them up, and that becomes this equation again. So please read and connect this physical picture that I provided here with the systems theory-like approach that is covered in my notes in consistency with what you learn in ECE 210. We will move on. Any questions? So now we want to apply. So here is the 210-like sort of argument. I have a delta coming in. Here is the response, blah, blah, blah. You've seen this in ECE 210. I shift it, then the response is shifted. Then I weight and superpose them. This guy has to be weighted superposed this way. And finally, this weighted superposed things with delta functions, according to convolution theorem, is just the rho itself. Rho produces its response, which is the integral that I have sort of like discussed through a physical means here. The general solution of Poisson's equation. Okay, so this can be used for various in various ways. I'm gonna now mention two uses of it, okay? And the two uses are gonna sort of like come very quickly in the next example. One use is that Poisson's equation is a mathematical statement that showed up in our study of electrostatics, but perhaps in other lines of studies, the same equation will show up with different variables. It's a different situation, but the math works out to be the same. Then we'll say, this is Poisson's equation. I know this from my electrostatic studies. I also know the solution of Poisson's equation, general solution of Poisson's equation. Therefore, in this new situation, I will reuse what I know from electrostatics. Okay? Professor Feynman has this thing he talks about when he's lecturing. His motto is same equations have same solutions. Okay? Physics is full of the same equation showing up in different contexts. You just learn its solution once, and the same solution can be used and reused with the right appropriate adjustment. Okay? So we're going to learn that this Poisson's equation and its general solution is very useful in that sense. Okay, that's one. The second one is I'm going to rely on this equation as well as Professor Feynman's motto, same equation have same solutions, to prove right now for you guys Helmholtz theorem. What was Helmholtz theorem? This is something that I mentioned maybe in lecture number one. If you know the divergence and the curl of a vector field, you can reconstruct this field, okay? So the proof is an outline. It's a quick one. It's not very rigorous, but it makes sense, and I hope you will remember it in the future. So that will give you some sort of a confidence in using Helmholtz theorem, which is an important thing to know. Okay, so suppose that F is a vector field. I want to show you guys that I can exactly write down what this vector field F is. F depends on x, y, z. And let's say that it fills the entire universe. And let's say that it peters out to zero away, all the way towards the edges. Let's make it a problem like this, okay? Now, if Helmholtz theorem says that if the region that you are working with is not infinite, but it is in a box, then in addition to knowing the divergence and the curl of the vector field, you have to know the fields at the boundaries. Then you can construct everything. But if you push the boundaries all the way to infinity and then make the fields go to zero, then there is nothing that you need to know at infinity. So that is the version that I'm going to provide a proof for. Okay? So I want to be able to write this in terms of this. Suppose I knew this, and suppose I knew this. Somehow then I can combine these two and write this. If I can do that, then Helmholtz was right. Okay? That's the plan. So here we go. Here is the argument. It's a little bit sort of like mind-boggling, but it's neat at the same time. So I don't know what my F is, but I know a few things that I have already learned in this class. Suppose that this F is a conservative field. What is a conservative field? A field whose curl is equal to zero. Then for sure I can write it as the gradient of some scalar potential. I can say F is equal minus gradient of V, okay? That minus is there for no good reason, but we can write that. Okay, because I don't know what V is. Certainly, I can start like that. But I have no assurance that F is a conservative field. Maybe F is not a conservative field. So then, writing just this is no good. Okay, certainly a portion of that field could be conservative, and that portion's curl goes to zero, but then it may have other parts that are not equal to zero in curl, so I have to add something else. With no loss generality, I add something else that resembles the first part. The first part was written in terms of a gradient, the second part I'm writing in terms of a curl. Not only there is a B that is needed, but also a vector field, A, that I don't know what it is, that perhaps is going to help me construct my F. In fact, let's just suppose that and work out the details of what B is and what A is. How am I going to find B and A that gives me my vector field that I need to express in terms of divergence of F and curl of F? Curl of A. No, curl of F, yes. But right now, there's another curl, A, in the picture. Any questions here? All right, so now, here's the solution. I go to my equation and I operate on it. First, I take the divergence of F and do some things. Then I take the curl of F and do something else. At the end of these two steps, I'm done with my proof. When I take the divergence of F, I have this term disappearing, right? That term is disappearing because the divergence of curl of A is always equal to zero, okay? And then what is the first term giving me? Del dot del. What is del dot del? Del dot del is yesterday's topic or today's topic. It is the? It is the Laplacian. Okay? So because the divergence of curl of A goes to zero, which is a vector identity, okay? Whenever you take a curl of something, its divergence is always equal to zero. Because curl of some vector field is another vector field. Certainly you can take its divergence, and divergence is always zero. Do you guys remember this from your vector calculus? Identities? One of them, all right? Okay, in any case, so that doesn't contribute. So there's another vector identity here. Curl of A is the gradient of divergence of A minus the Laplacian of A. That is also going to be used. So there are these vector identities that students should learn and then remember where they are. They are always in Google and Wikipedia. Remember where that they exist and use them, okay? And I think in one of the homework problems that is coming up, in perhaps problem number 3, this identity is reminded to you. You guys are asked to confirm it. Is that right? People working on number 3? Okay. So also in our website, there is a page, a list of useful vector identities. That is useful, really useful, coming from another useful collection of formulas called NRL Plasma Formulary. NRL is Naval Research Laboratories. Google, NRL Plasma Formulary. You can download a PDF of maybe 100 pages of formula that electrical engineers use a lot. Okay. Anyway, so my page was a ripoff from the NRL Plasma Formulary. Use that. Okay. So anyway, so what did we get? We took the divergence of the first line. The last term didn't contribute. We have divergence of F is equal to minus del square V. Have you seen this equation before? Have you seen this equation before? Maybe slightly differently.
Yeah.
When did we see it? Last lecture and this lecture. It's sitting over there. Okay, this is just like Poisson's equation, except that instead of rho, what do I have here? Instead of rho or epsilon, I have divergence of F. So now, let's apply Professor Feynman's motto. Same equations have same solutions. We have the solution of Poisson's equation in terms of rho. Let's change that equation by replacing rho appropriately with the new guy. What is the new guy replacing rho? It is divergence of F times epsilon naught, something like that. Okay, so here we go. This is Poisson's equation general formula. We used to have a rho here and epsilon naught in the bottom. That rho over epsilon naught has been replaced by divergence of F. Same equation, same formula. So now, I have suddenly a formula for V that is in terms of divergence of F, okay? That V, if I know it, I can reconstruct F, all right? So now I have seen how a vector field depends on its divergence in some sort of a unique way. Okay, so the second step is sort of similar, okay? This time, we take the curl of the first equation, and what is the curl of a gradient? Gradient of a scalar is a vector quantity, and its curl is equal to? Say it.
Zero.
And how do you know that? That is because curl of E was equal to zero. We were able to replace E as the gradient of a vector. Okay, so that's the fact that we were really familiar with. The fact that the other fact that divergence of curl is equal to zero is something slightly unfamiliar. But we're going to get there too, okay? Because we know an important electromagnetic property that has zero divergence. What is always zero divergence-wise?
B.
Exactly. Divergence of B is equal to zero. And therefore, B's can always be represented as the curls of A's. Because when you take the divergence of curls of A's, they're always equal to zero. So while electrostatic fields can be represented in terms of scalar potential B through its minus gradient operation, we will find out that magnetic fields can always be attacked as the curl of A. Okay, because divergence of curl of A is equal to zero. So that was that. All right, but now we take the curl of this equation and we have something, a new animal to encounter. Curl of F is curl of A. And then we use this identity that you guys are working in homework number 3, which is sort of a mouthful here. The gradient of a divergence minus the Laplacian A. Okay? Gradient of a divergence. Does that make sense? It does. Because when you take the divergence of a vector field, it becomes a scalar. Therefore, it is gradientable. Okay? So the first term is making sense. And the second is also making sense. Okay? So now, this sort of like, I want to apply, again, Professor Feynman's rule. Same equations have same solutions, okay? But this is more complicated. I'm going to say, you know, what if divergence of A was equal to zero? Okay, I don't know what A is to begin with. I'm trying to solve an A that works for my purposes here. Let's assume that divergence of A is equal to zero. If divergence of A is equal to zero, this guy disappears. Then I have curl of F is equal to minus the Laplacian of A. Same equations, same solutions. What is the solution for A then? Actually, it's a little bit more complicated because A is a vector and our first Poisson's equation was a scalar equation, right? But a Poisson's equation at the vector level is three Poisson's equations because vectors have three components. There is the x component, y component, and the z component of this equation. And each of them are scalar equations, just like the original Poisson's equation. Is that making sense, that argument? Okay, so I'm going to apply Feynman's rule. Same equation, same solutions. Except that, instead of rho, I have now curl of E, curl of F. Curl of half, F has to go into here. And I'm done. I can get A. If I know curl of F, I can get V if I have the divergence of F. And if I have A and V, I can operate them to get F. So that is Helmholtz equation or Helmholtz theorem proven for you guys. In terms of what? In terms of what we learned today, the general solution of Poisson's equation. Along with the lecture that Poisson's equation is going to show up in many, many different contexts. Whenever you see it, use it. Use the solution that you're learning here today. Questions? So we are done with today's lecture. Yesterday's lecture. Now today's lecture is starting. Which means that we are a little bit behind. Conductors, dielectrics, polarization. Now we want to move on in our discussion of material media. We are moving away from just plain vacuum. Already we encountered conductors a little bit last lecture, right? A conductor was this. We were talking about conducting metals, conducting solids, like copper. Okay, in steady state, they have zero electric field inside. Therefore, you can associate with them a constant potential throughout. If the electric field is zero inside, then the divergence of electric field is also zero inside, which means the charge density is also zero inside. There is no charge density in steady state for a conductor. If there are charges on the conductor, they are not inside. Therefore, they are on the surface. Okay? And the field being inside, outside, with a perhaps a non-zero surface charge density, you have the possibility of jumping from zero field to non-zero field outside. And that is the sort of capacitor problem that we already did. So we know quite a bit about conductors. Yes. I'm going to say a few more things, and then we're going to go into dielectrics. Now, what differentiates a conductor from a dielectric is the following. The conductors are full of what we call free electrons. You understand what a free electron is by thinking about the reverse of the free electron. The reverse of a free electron is a bound electron. And what is a bound electron? A bound electron is the electron in a hydrogen atom. It is bound in the sense that it is always together with its mate, the proton. They are sort of like doing their whatever dance, quantum dance. But when you apply an electric field, you are unable to sort of pull away the electron away from its mate indefinitely. Unless you apply such a large electric field that you rip it off. Okay, you can do that. Then there is a breakdown. But with mild electric fields, the electron stays together with the proton, and therefore there is no current that you generate by applying an electric field in the vicinity of a collection of hydrogen atoms. There is no DC current that you can generate. What about AC current? What if you apply AC? For DC current to happen, the current should be steady and never changing, and that would require that electron is departing from its proton forever. And you just guys all agreed that that's not going to happen. Therefore, there is no DC current. Well, what about an AC current? What if I apply an electric field that's doing this? Is there going to be a current? Yes, there is going to be a current. This is what we call polarization current. What happens is that each of these atoms are stretched. The electron is pulled away, but it's not going to leave, because then the electric field is going to decide to go the other way, and it will push the electron. So there is going to be back and forth motion of the electron across the proton. Yes. You can have neutral hydrogen gas that can carry polarization currents, AC currents, but not DC currents. Okay? So the difference between bound electrons and the free electrons is what distinguishes between conducting and dielectric materials. Okay? In something like a copper or in an ionized gas, you have these free electrons that will actually carry DC currents if there is a DC applied field. Okay, but if the region is bounded, then this motion is going to dump the charges at the boundaries, which will then generate electric fields, and then those electric fields can cancel the original fields and go into zero electric field situation internally. And that is what this picture is showing here. You have a conducting body being inserted into a region where there is an original electric field because of there are some other charges that exist. And in the conducting body, the electrons are pulled towards the positive charges. They are accelerated in the direction opposite to the applied electric field. And therefore, they accumulate on the bottom boundary, leaving the top boundary with plus charges. And this process goes on until the field is exactly zeroed out inside, and then there is no more charge transport. That is the steady state. That steady state is achieved incredibly fast, okay, for good conductors like copper. I gave you a number the other day. It is like 10 to the 18th, minus 18 seconds or so it takes for this to happen. And because that is so fast, we'll say, whenever you have DC situations, the conductors are going to have zero electric field inside. That's pretty much that what we want to say. Unless we take this conductor, bend it into a closed loop, and insert somewhere in this closed loop a battery, and then we start sustaining a current flow, okay? That can be a DC situation, but not steady state in the previous sense that I have talked about. And if you want to read more about that, the two papers that I have sent out to you guys are actually dealing with aspects of what's going on there. Okay, that is not typically covered in textbooks, but those two papers are very valuable because they are sort of like talking about things that you often customarily skip in various courses. Not in this course, we are covering it because I distributed those papers. Read them. Okay, so that is the situation with the conductor. Basically, the presence of a conductor is shorting out the electric field that was there. You go from a finite electric field down to zero. When you stick in, instead of a conductor, the electric material, that shorting doesn't take place. But the electric field changes nevertheless, because there is a stretching of the individual atoms that constitutes the electric material. In the electric material, instead of free charge carriers existing within the body, all the electrons are paired up with their protons and neutrons that they together form atoms and molecules with, And it is only slight displacement of the negatively charged electron cloud from the positively charged nucleus that gives to the little polarization effect that we're going to be talking about. Any questions here? Okay, so what else do I want to say about conductivity? Conductivity, we will do more and more with conductivity. Conductivity, a conducting material such as copper has associated with a parameter that we call sigma, which is the conductivity. Ultimately, every material is going to be characterized by its epsilon, mu, and sigma. Okay? Epsilon is going to be epsilon naught times some relative epsilon. And that is going to come about because of this polarization effect that I will be talking, not today, obviously, I'm half a lecture late, but tomorrow, okay? And there is going to be a mu, which is mu sub naught times the relative mu, that is because of a magnetization effect, that is the analogous to polarization effect that we'll talk within a week from now, more or less. And you guys are now packing up, thinking that time is up. But I have 2-3 minutes. I think. All right, so conductivity is an important property, therefore, okay? And conductivity relates electric field to the corresponding current density. J is sigma E. In vacuum, sigma is equal to zero. There is, therefore, no J. And I would say that also conductivity is something that belongs. It's a collective property, okay? You don't talk about the conductivity of a single molecule. You talk about the conductivity of a material that is a big material. It has lots of atoms. In that sense, it's a collective, an emergent property. There are some idealizations. We will talk about perfect electrical conductors. We will imagine existence of materials for which the sigma is equal to infinite. Okay? If that is the case, that material cannot ever have electric field in it. Okay? A perfect electric conductor is like a perfect short, okay? A perfect short in a circuit cannot sustain any voltage difference, okay? It will carry whatever current it has to carry in completing the circuit, but at the expense of no voltage. In a similar way, if we have these idealizations of perfect electrical conductors, there can be never any electric field in it. It can carry some current for continuity purposes, okay? So that's a possibility, but in real life, we don't have that, okay? But some stuff, like copper, silver, etc., have such high conductivities is that sometimes we use this perfect electrical conductor as an idealization to treat them in ways that we will see. If sigma goes to infinity, to zero, the other extreme, then whatever the electric field is, there's not going to be any J, and that is a perfect insulator, okay? Ideal, the electrics have that property at DC, okay? But as we talked about, in AC, there can be currents. And then there are superconductors. But superconductors is something else. Superconductors have sigma going to infinity, but only for the DC case. In the AC case, they are not so super. But if you have a superconductor, these are certain materials that go through a phase transition when they are cooled a lot, and they become forever sustainer of DC currents. You make a loop out of a superconductor, and if it's in a superconducting state, you put a DC current in it, it goes on forever, for years and years and years. And literally, the resistivity is exactly equal to zero. And where was this invented or explained? Here, yes. Who was the guy? Bardeen, the same guy. Yeah, Bardeen got Nobel Prize twice, right? One for the transistors, the second for superconductivity. Okay. All right, so that much about conductors. And now, copper. It's not a PEC. It's a very good conductor. In AC situations, the copper block is not going to have exactly zero electric fields. There will be electric fields at the surface of a copper block, but it will go to zero exponentially over a very short distance. This is called the skin effect. Okay? That in DC steady state, copper has exactly zero electric field inside. Okay? In AC, it is not, but it is almost zero because skin effect is, the skin is so narrow, so thin. Okay? Whereas for the ideal conductor, PEC, it's zero, whether AC or DC. So these are certain things to keep in mind. Now I run out of time. Thank you. Tomorrow we look at not the conductors, but the polarizable dielectrics.